Support comes from Strategic Farm Marketing, sponsor of the annual customer seminars. This virtual or in-person program will provide tools for the demands and challenges of managing a farm business in today's environment, along with updates on the latest federal and private crop insurance products and new program ECO, Enhanced Coverage Option.
This is the March 4 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day are Bill Biederman from AgMarket.net, Dave Chatterton from Strategic Farm Marketing, and Dale Durkles from Grain Cycles. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. You can find us online and listen to us on demand anytime that you would like. Bill Biederman, I'd like to get a list of items maybe you think are worth discussing for the week. What do you have?
Well, I think it's, you know, a lot of the focus is, will the battle of competition in South America and a shift of seasonal shipping, down to there really cap our market for good, or is this just kind of temporary, and are we looking at some possibilities if we don't get too many acres? So, you know, how many acres are we going to get? And that'll determine whether we can make new highs later on, and of course, weather.
Dave Chatterton.
Hey, Todd. There's a number of different things we can look at. I think the ongoing pace of the U.S. Exports, particularly in soybeans, is an issue, and how we're going to balance the U.S. Ending stocks in soybeans. I think the transition that we've got going on from a demand-led bull market in the U.S. based on that export and crush demand over to a South American supply and soon to be a U.S. planting window type of a discussion is important. I think China is a good topic. I mean, record corn and soybean imports on the books right now. Are they going to take all this corn? Is ASF, a worse problem than what we're being led to believe and potentially a bearish item for the market? So there's always a lot of moving parts here.
And Dale Durkles.
Yeah, I think Dave pretty much covered the whole board there. The only thing I'd add to it, people need to be aware of what's going in the foreign exchange market here. We got the dollar here as we're speaking today up above the highs we had back at the beginning of February. And the other thing beyond that is the recognition and maybe what people think about the expanded limits, position limits funds are going to have starting the middle of the month.
Well, let's start there. Can you explain what the position limit change might mean, and are you worried about it?
Well, I don't know. I'm really worried about it. It's going to be interesting. I think people need to just simply be aware and take note of the fact that starting on the 15th, the big trading funds are going to be able to essentially, double their positions that they have in any of the grains. I don't think it's necessarily immediately important, given the fact that, they've already got a pretty hefty long position on corn. They did have on beans, but they've worked that off a little bit. And so beans may be the one to kind of keep an eye on. It's just going to be important to be aware of that when we hit the 15th, what kind of things are going on in the market that day or, the days immediately following that, and to kind of be sensitive that, these guys have more buying power or selling power than they had before.
Dave Chatterton, one of the things you mentioned intrigues me. What is it that you meant by the transition from a demand-led marketplace to a supply-led marketplace from Brazil?
Well, I think it's almost a volatility play. We had a very strong rally going back last spring, last summer, very consistent demand bull market when U.S. exports were running off the charts at record values. We had crush numbers setting records month after month after month, and some of that is still true, but we're now shifting that focus over to, South America has, discounted values versus U.S. Gulf offerings for corn and for soybeans. The business is typically switching over to them. Harvesting soybeans is gaining speed and will soon be over, but, the Safrinha corn crop has a lot of, it's barely, not even in the ground yet. A lot of it's still in the bag. It's going to be a long time before we know the fate of that situation. So that comes into play here, Todd. I mean, the early yield numbers that we were hearing out of South America, highly variable. They've calmed down here a little bit. I think most people are starting to see yields improve. We've had some quality issues in the northern part where rains have been heavy. They've been harvesting wet beans and, in an effort to get Safrinha corn planted in a timely manner. And that's going to cause some issues at the ports with, we've heard of docks that have exceeded 20% and 25% and, trouble, meeting grades and different things, but I think that problem will go by. But in general, the focus is going to be about what the final soybean yield is in South America. I don't think there's any big surprises there, but we'll have to wait. We still have a few people projecting a crop below 130, but you know, the crowd is in that 132, 133, 134 range. But you know, 75% of the Brazilian corn production is a safrinha or a second base crop that goes in behind. It's going in, you know, basically February, early March, going in behind a full season bean. And you know, because of a late bean planting window and thus a late, you know, bean harvest window, that big portion of that crop is going in late will be subject to some pollination risk as the dry season wears on. So that's something the market will have to wear here for a while. And then, you know, a month from now, as Dale indicated, we're going to see planters start to roll here in the U.S. And it's, you know, we're going to talk a lot about acres and how things go.
I will make that transition to you, Bill Biederman, because you mentioned both of these things in, off the top of this show as it relates to the competition coming out of South America and whether it will cap prices in Chicago or not, and then, of course, what that means for the acreage battle in the United States, corn or soybeans.
Yeah, we're concerned to how long will this seasonal time that we're in right now last. Obviously, if we get a mass increase in acres, you know, the USDA can come out with any number they want to. I mean, we can come up with the numbers that we feel are correct. And quite honestly, in the last 3 years, we've seen USDA revise all their numbers down to what the private industry has said the last 3 years. But having said that, USDA has a history of either finding 4 million ghost acres or losing 4 and surprising the trade. So, you know, a lot of us have 91 million acres of corn and, beans and 92 and a quarter, something like that on the corn. Maybe they'll find 4 million more acres. There's 10 million acres in prevent plant last year. So usually you only have 1.7. So there's a lot of acres. The question will be whether we plant that or not, it doesn't even matter. That's if they do that, the headline fund traders who can double their positions now will have that information on their books. That'll be what they're using until they figure out what reality is. So, you know, we're trading between what's reality. Hey, reality is this. We've got 30 days of supply around our crushers and our grinders. And beyond that, there might be 30 to 45 days of inventory out in the country. What are we going to do come late May, June, July? Where are we going to buy the inputs to keep these plants going? That's reality. Perception of what we trade headline is, oh, we got 1.5 billion bushels of corn out there. It's no big deal. And you know, we had 640 million bushels of carryover and beans were down to 120, but they're not going to lower it below that. Why would they? They'll just lower the residual. So there's a reality of trying to run a business, and there's the perception of what are we trading headline. And I think that's going to all play out. I think we're in a time period right now where we could go sideways. But when we get to that May, June, July period, when you can't buy grain, I think reality could blow the top off this, especially if we have a weather problem and we go into a supply market problem like what Dave was saying.
So you're of the opinion that rationing has not taken place to this point, or not very much anyway.
Our current use on soybeans is about 40 million bushel over USDA, according to our records. So that rationing has not occurred. The corn demand on exports is right in line, we believe, with what USDA is expecting. Ethanol could back off a little bit. We're going to keep it the same. Feed use, we still believe, is a smidge bigger than what USDA is saying. So all in all, corn number is, we believe, will eventually get revised down to 1350 versus the 1500 we're working with for carryover. But a lot of that's based on the stocks that we see out there and how hard it is to buy.
Dale, can you offer a contrarian view?
And you know, the one thing when you look at it, you know, he talked about the acreage number to start there first. You know, we've got to stop and remember, when you look at total acreages in the U.S. plus prevent plant plus CRP, we've lost somewhere in the ballpark of about 10, 12 million acres since back in 2013. You know, he's right in talking, you know, last year we had prevent plant, you know, at 10 million. And if you have a good year, you get down to 1.5 to 2. So, you know, you're basically saying, you know, I got somewhere 7.5, maybe 8 million acres if spring is reasonably decent that can come back in. But I also have to address the fact that, you know, these crop insurance guarantees are the highest they've been going back into, I think it's 2013, although one of them might be 2014. You know, and so producers, and we were talking about that before we started, producers have lots of incentive to plant acres this year. So I think if, you know, the spring season is good, acres will get planted. I'm basically using 1 million each higher than USDA is on corn and beans. I wouldn't be surprised at 1.5 million or maybe 2 in the final end, but we won't know that probably until June. You know, as far as, you know, looking at the carryout on corn and the ability to buy product out there, I think that part of that's really a market situation. You know, we've gotten hung up in prices up here at these levels at this point. I think farmers have just gotten real comfortable with the market at this particular juncture in time. The thing I look at here at this point, you know, when you look at corn in particular, that seems to be maybe just a little bit more weak-kneed than beans, surprisingly, you know, with the crop shifting to South America or the market focus shifting to South America. If I break below 4.25 on May corn, I'll be blunt. I don't see anything to stop it to 4.5. I mean, we could just hit a fun wash. Now, if I break the futures down to 4.5, you're going to buy a lot of corn as you get back upwards of $4.75 and $5 again. So I think it's basically an producer attitude in the bushels that he still has that are a huge part of this mix at this point. And to a lesser degree, some of that's probably true for beans, although overall the whole bean thing is tighter. You know, he talked about adjusting the residual on beans, which will be adjusted a little bit. The one thing we need to understand here, too, you know, if we get the differential between U.S. and South America out far enough, you know, we can import more beans. We've done as much as 70 million bushel. That goes back in, I think, 2013 when we did that at the end of that marketing year. And so we could add 20, 25, 30, 35 million bushel of beans as long as the economic incentive is right to bring them in.
Just as a reference point, you talked about base price for crop insurance, 2013 at $5.65, and we ended with a $4.39 harvest price that year. 2014, $4.62, and we ended with a $3.49 price that year. And I did go back earlier today, in fact, because I was thinking about this and looked at the ending stocks for 14 to 15. And we went from 1.2 billion in 2014 to 1.9 in 2015. So I'm wondering whether 1.45, and I know we've added a lot of demand since then, but is that much different than the 1.2? At that point? And if we're looking at, can we look at that kind of increase?
Well, you know, when you get into the stocks and you start looking at the old crop number, a lot of the, what I'll call the emotional attitude about them is actually going to be ended up being tied up into what kind of potential new crop number can we be working with? And that's really an unknown because we don't really even have a solid acreage number to work with at this point, nor do we have, you know, any good concept of yield beyond a trend yield, which I think USDA is still a little bit too high as far as their trend yield numbers, you know, by 2 to 3 bushels. But, you know, that new crop will start to have influence on how people perceive, you know, the old crop number itself. If I get, let's say, 1.5 million more acres than what the USDA said, get up to 93.5 or maybe even 94, you know, on corn, you know, and if I'm looking at a good-looking crop off to a good start early on, you know, that's a different attitude looking at 1.4 billion or 1.35 billion, for example, than if we don't get those things early on, too, as far as the new crop. So those new crop attitudes have a lot of impact on the perception of how tight or not tight those old crop numbers are.
Well, what does 92 show you? And if you just use normal years.
What do you mean? What does 92 show me?
Well, 92 and whatever yield you want to use for a normal year. What does that show you for next year's carryout?
Well, my trend yield I'm using is about 176.5 at this point. You know, The 92, I think they were conservative on the game. You know, I originally this year plugged in 94 million. I backed it off to about 93 in trying to look at what the USDA might be getting ready to say. But, you know, I just think if there's going to be any shift, barring weather problems in the spring, the acreage numbers on both corn and beans probably both going to go up. And I think we'll see that on the report at the end of the month. So I've already discarded the 92, and I work with a 93.
Bill, what numbers are you working with?
92.25 on corn, 179.5 yield, and we're coming up with a 1.54 old carryover. So, you know, it's not going to be a big jump, and it's not going to move us towards a secure feeling. This could be a 1 to 2 year market unless those acres exceed, you know, 92.5, it's going to be hard to be too bullish or, you know, even range bound, that's what you try to forecast, what range will we be in. But when you look at the trend of the Chinese buying, you really have to look at the last 6 years and study that trend and study what is happening over there. And it's not just in China, it's in Asia. Their total feed use has increased even before their herd size reached the levels that they're at today. And we suspect a year from today, their hog herd will be at 104% of where it was before this all started. And the security of the, how they feed and produce pork is way higher. I mean, way higher than it was. They've got, you know, everybody's seen those pictures of, you know, four-story high-rise buildings for hogs. You know, that's pretty amazing technology. So they've got a big population. From a standpoint of geopoliticalness, you go back and read their history, they're going to feed those people. I mean, that's how Mao lost. His whole power was from a famine, you know, and that's not going to happen again.
Dave, what do you have to add?
Well, I mean, the conversation has been, you know, has been good, and it's been primarily about corn, but I think of more interest, and as Bill pointed out, I mean, I think most analysts are using a carry out, let's just say plus or minus 1.5 or 1.45 for new crop 21-22 corn. I think the issue is really going to be around beans, and even if we pencil in, you know, we're going to use 90 million acres on our bean balance sheet for next year, we're going to use a 51 yield. We're coming up with 150 carry out, and that may be generous if this carry in number shrinks more than what we anticipate. And that's going to mean that next year we have a lot of pressure on this bean balance sheet. We have, I guess, very little room for error might be the way to say that. And with the market expectation of an additional 6.5-7 million acres of beans coming into play, as we've talked about, the economic incentive is certainly there to get that done, but Mother Nature also has something to say about that. And even if those acres do go in, if they happen to go in late or wet or whatever the case might be, and then you pick up the summer weather argument about yield, any kind of sensitivity around that production number for yield, and especially if the South American, you know, let's say the Brazilian crop comes in maybe just a little bit shy of expectations, we continue to have a U.S. and a world balance sheet in soybeans that is very tight going forward and really has no room for error. And so it could be a very interesting, very long summer, especially with these increased speculative limits that we've just talked about.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that, too, because if you go back and study history, there's really only about 4 years that line up with similar statistics of what happened. And during those years, one of them, it had an economic inflationary tilt to it, just like, you know, we don't just have the U.S. providing stimulus. We've got the entire world. That's never, ever happened before. We don't know what that's going to do to the economy, to inflation, things like that. If you ask the U.N., it's getting out of control. But the point being is, if you start seeing funds' ability to build a position twice what it is, if you start really seeing inflationary pressure on this thing, which would, of course, make the dollar go lower yet, and then you throw into it some kind of a weather scare during the summer, like we just talked about, you've got the perfect storm for this thing to just, I mean, honestly, we're being very cautious how we hedge this year so that we don't have margin call problems. It could be crazy. And yet at the same time, if we do have a market that kicks into a perfect storm, it's going to ruin our market because we'll go too high. So if that's the case, you also have to have a plan on how to take advantage of that on a multi-year hedge. So, you know, guys like us, we sit around for hours trying to figure out how to keep people in a position that provides protection, but also provides an opportunity to gain on the upside when it's there, because you can't compete unless you do on the farm. But also we have to have a game plan where, okay, what if this does go to $18? You know, what the elasticity of this market is going to drop out of the bottom if we have a bad weather scenario, because like you just said, there's not going to be a lot of stocks next year, and that's using the trend line yield. So, you know, it's just like when gas went to $4, I didn't buy less gas. I just paid a heck of a lot more for it. I still went to work every day, and that's how food is. So when you're a fund trader and there's an inflation thing, you buy food and you buy fuel. Those are your main components to your formula. So we just have to see what the weather does.
So in either case, inflation or weather, are you sell and defend at this point?
Well, the insurance is covering us right now, right? So we don't have to get too worried about it right this minute. But, you know, I'll just tell you what we're doing. We've got every bushel we sold on old crop, we've replaced it with some type of an option strategy. We've already moved those options up once and have done very well. And we're going to maintain that for another $2 up on beans and $1 up on corn. And we've put a smidge of new crop options in place that didn't cost us much that we'll be selling against probably around 520. And we've already got some hedges on the books, but pretty much everything we have is got a hedge against it, or an option that we didn't pay a lot for. You know, maybe we were doing some today for a penny, but they were, you know, they were strategies. They weren't just like an outright call. And we got some guys just buying outright calls too. But point is, all of us in this chat room right now are doing things like this to get in position to protect our clients from a mass upside while protecting their revenue in case we get a black swan. And you have to do that. And then what you have to do in this year, because this could become a reality, is if we have like what one of these other 4 years projects potentially too, you have to have a multi-year hedge plan. And that those are difficult to do. I've done them before, and it takes a lot of capital to fund those kinds of positions. And you won't find an elevator out there who will take that on, because they're afraid of the margin money too. So you really need to be forward thinking on this and say, okay, here's some plans that would work if this happens. Because I'll tell you what, in the middle of that football game, when they're in the third quarter, you don't have time to think. You've got to have a plan.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about this kind of quickly, Dale, but he mentioned that, you know, crop insurance has you covered on part of it, that as long as you don't take HPE, would be the case for 70, 75, 80, 85%, depending on what you purchase for crop insurance. And as Bill laid it out, in my mind, it's not about protecting revenue in that case. It's about having enough revenue to pay the inflated price for inputs in the following year. That sounds scary to me.
Are we sure we're going to have inflated prices for inputs too? You know, that's another thing that we got to step back from the phrase sometime and you know, start to pull back and start to look at things somewhat objectively. To begin with, this whole game is almost a year old now. We've got to deal with that. When you go back and look at long history of things, you know, in terms of the grain markets, or even when you look at a long history of commodity indices to try to look at commodity prices as an aggregate over a long period of time, you basically see, you know, and Scott Irwin covered this, I think, a year ago now when they had the farm meetings that they do every year in December. You know, we had a big shift. We ran prices up extraordinarily high post-World War II. Then we kind of went into a broad sideways market all the way through the rest of the 50s and into the 60s. And then finally in the early 70s, we cut this big push again. You know, we went to extraordinarily high prices. That one was dollar-linked, dollar-related. And you know, then we went into this long period through the 80s and the 90s and into the early 2000s. And then we saw this build again, where we took prices to extraordinarily high prices, big investment money flowed in. We also had weakness in the dollar on the way in here. You know, and I think we've got to step back and you need to start to look. A lot of people keep talking about this dollar weakness is going to be ahead. And I'm still not so sure at that at this point, because one thing we've been doing in the foreign exchange market over the last 4 to 5 to maybe 6, 7 years, in a lot of cases, we've been playing a game of competitive devaluations. And we can see that with negative rates over in Europe right now. German banks are starting to refuse to accept money because they're paying negative rates on money. When I look at the dollar and what's gone on, and you know, some of the people have seen this, admittedly, short sample, but when you look at change of administrations, we end up with change in trend of the dollar, it seems like. And, you know, we've been sideways to lower now during Trump's administration, and that would argue that you know, we're getting ready to see the dollar start to move higher again, potentially. If you look at a cyclic pattern in the dollar, and I'll not get into the fundamental aspects of foreign exchange analysis because that's real complicated, but there's roughly a low about every 3 years, and we're due for a dollar low here. And as I said, you know, in starting the show, we had the dollar close today above the highs we had back at the beginning of February, and really kind of giving the sense that the dollar really is building a base for a move up. And if that's the case, it really kind of starts to undermine all this talk about bullish commodity prices, high inflation here in the U.S. in particular. So I guess right now I'm a little bit careful on playing this game about inflation. Also remembering that I go back roughly a year ago, back in April, May, June, there wasn't a person in the world worried about it. But if you were a student of cycles, you knew that we were coming into a major low in a lot of prices at that point, especially as you look at some of the grains and you look at commodity indices themselves. But you don't rocket straight higher out of these things either. And we've come a long way to the upside when you look at the broad game of commodity indices. And, you know, you start to think, are we getting long in the tooth at this point in time and going to move in? And what I fear that we're going to move into here is not necessarily a bull market, but between now and summer, and, you know, both Dave and Bill mentioned it, I think it could be extremely volatile. And it's going to be important. But if you break the market hard, you change the attitude for a while. And it always takes a while to rebuild that game, too. So I just worry about the volatility coming into the game at this point. And I don't buy the big inflation game right away.
Dale, in similar cycle type setups historically, how long of duration can that upward side of that cycle last?
For dollar commodities?
No, for corn and bean, commodities. Yeah.
Oh, commodities in general. Well, you know, when you go back and you look at, and I don't remember exactly the one we had back right post World War II. Whether I don't remember if that was peak was in the late 40s or right at the beginning of the 50s. But you know, it was all the way until we hit the early 70s. 20 years later, before we really started a major move up again. If you look at the one after the one we had in the 70s, and depending on what you look at, you get different peaks, because commodity indices actually then peaked in 1980 because of the big push in gold we had there right at the end of the 70s. But, you know, that one there, that peak, we were sideways to lower all the way into right at the end of the 90s. You remember the grain market, we had the big lows back there in the late 1980s, or excuse me, in the middle 80s. It was 86, I think. And, you know, they basically just chopped sideways, and it wasn't until we passed the lows in 04, 05 that the whole thing really started with the grain, started to move upward again, and that was big investment money. So those are big long-term changes in the market, and they do kind of go hand-in-hand with, you know, dollar valuation, and that's why I go back. You know, everybody keeps talking about weakness in the dollar, weakness in the dollar. If I look domestically, I can understand what they're saying, but you have to understand it's a game of competitive devaluations in the world that's important too, and has been. And if that's the case, you know, the dollar may end up being strong relative to some other currencies for the next couple of years here again. And that works against prices that you and I see and the farmers here in the U.S. see.
Let's turn our attention to dealing with old crop corn. I don't think we have to worry about soybeans. Farmers will do what they need to do or what they want to do with what little is left.
Don't they always?
Yeah, even with the corn. So the question is, given all that we've talked about, the volatility I think that everybody agrees is likely to be around, no matter which direction you're thinking about, what should producers do with old crop corn? And I'm going to guess they have somewhere between 25 and 40% of that crop left to market. Dave Chatterton, where do they start?
Yeah, Todd, I think that's probably a pretty accurate gauge of where we're at currently. And, you know, it's a situation where if you've been patient to this point, I think you can probably afford to do that a little bit more here. The straight-up nature of the market that we talked about and kind of this transition is over for now, but we're looking at a situation where I think there's a lot of risk around that South American crop as far as yield risk because of the pollination period, the drying period, et cetera. That doesn't mean fall asleep at the wheel. It doesn't mean sell. So it doesn't mean don't sell, you know, attractive or profitable values. I think it does mean exactly kind of a point Bill went back to, and this is something exactly the same thing that we're doing in our shop or with our clients, is that when we make those sales and we eliminate that downside and we've locked in a profitable level because of the setup this summer and the potential for a kind of leaps and bounds upward market under the right weather conditions, we are buying typically call spreads, but some kind of an option strategy against that position to keep ourselves in the game if we have that. And that's true of both corn and soybeans for old crop. I think it's even true for producers who are making new crop sales. So if you haven't educated yourself about options, and I know a lot of people haven't, I know they don't want to have that discussion, but it's going to be a very important tool going forward here this summer to give you that flexibility and that confidence to make that sale and know that, hey, you know, 2 months from now, 3 months from now, I'm not going to be a dollar wrong about where the corn price was.
We're 80% sold, and we're going to gamble with the rest. So we're going to just wait till it quits going up. But I will say on that 80% sold, we're really well covered with options, and we're really comfortable with them. I mean, you know, when they hit our kick-out price, we let them kick out, and then we replace them with something that we can accept the risk of. And, you know, when you do it that way, you keep your risks way, you know, you keep your costs down. Our costs are between 6 cents and a credit. You know, so we feel real good about what we've done, and we're going to maintain that position.
Dale?
You know, when I look at old crop corn, especially when I look at a billion and a half or a billion four, pick a number, on where we end up, it's going to be somewhat comfortable. Old crop corn to me is probably the one that doesn't have as much potential to make a move as whether we want to talk either the new crops or even old crop beans. In my mind, I look at old crop corn, I look at it and I go, how many bushels do I want to gamble with through planting and on into summer? Everything else is sold. You know, I understand, you know, using some kind of an option strategy. I do like bull call spreads, you know, to replace, you know, stuff that I've sold. But I'll be honest at this point. I'd rather just make the cash sales on corn, except for what I want to carry for gambling inventories. I would rather reserve my margin money account to try to manage my new crop position than my old crop position. So I just don't see the need to want to re-own any old crop stuff at this point in time as far as corn is concerned. I'd rather try to use my available margin money to manage a new crop position.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may listen to the whole of our program anytime you'd like at willag.org, willag.org. Our thanks go to our panelists this week. They include Dale Durkles at Grain Cycles, Dave Chatterton from Strategic Farm Marketing, and Bill Biederman at agmarket.net. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.